a very simple button mechanism for online websites to onboard PayPal payments to their checkout flows was like a large part of their success in PayPal's adoption. This is essentially that PayPal moment, or could be that PayPal moment, could be that PayPal moment for crypto payments.
Before we get into today's episode, just a quick disclaimer. The views expressed on this podcast by either myself or any guests are their personal views and do not represent the views of any associated organization. Nothing in this episode should be construed or relied upon as financial, technical, tax, legal, or other advice. All right, let's jump into the episode.
Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of ZeroX Research. The research team is back to bring you another analyst roundtable. Today is Monday, April 29th, but this episode will go live Wednesday, March 1st. I'm joined by Brick, Ryan, and Carolina from the BlockWorks research team to talk about what's happening in the markets. So, last week, Stripe brought back crypto payments and demoed it on Phantom. Also, earlier today, they announced that they will be using Avalanche for crypto payments as well. Obviously, Stripe is mainly used by small businesses, but I feel like this is a new path in the US because Stripe's a US company. It's interesting to see like the diversion between regulation and what US businesses are doing in terms of crypto. Do you guys have any takes?
I mean, maybe let me start by saying, Bucko, it's an honor to be on your show. Been a long time listener, so great to be here. But yeah, I think this is a great avenue for like crypto to maybe get integrated more into the business environment, so to say, because I feel like a lot of these smaller companies would be somewhat willing to maybe experiment with like crypto payments, but without the like underlying infrastructure, of course, there's no way for companies to like try out any of these new things. Like, I'm in the EU, and to my knowledge, if you're a small business or even a medium-sized business, there's no way for you to even like begin trying out these new payment styles. And yeah, like stablecoins have a great product market fit, so it makes sense to also add this type of stuff for like businesses. And yeah, I feel like it's just a natural development for the industry, and hope this kind of grows adoption. And then from there, I don't know, the normies, the regular people, whatever you want to call them, are also more incentivized than to try out more stuff on chain, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think I'm also based out in the EU, so I agree with you on that, is that like crypto is not used over here at all. But like in the Middle East and in Asia as well, I feel like they've had this infrastructure for quite some time. And I don't think they use it for like regular, I'd say like traditional venues, but it's mostly just through like wallet to wallet or OTC a lot of the time as well. So it's interesting to see like more regulated and like, I don't want to say like more developed, but let's say more developed countries try and actually start adopting crypto for small businesses and I guess like regular transactions.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing is, like, I guess the stuff you talked about earlier is more because people are kind of forced to do that in a way, because some entities don't have any kind of like underlying payments infrastructure in the first place, who are in these more like developing countries. Meanwhile, I feel like if the market takes off in, for example, the US, then it has the like ability to kind of develop even further from there, and then like you get even more power users on chain. But I don't know if this is a stupid stake, so.
I don't know what the Stripe to power user on chain pipeline is like, but I mean, it's always just good to have people use the chain.
It's good. It's a good development. It certainly eliminates friction. The most interesting, like Web 2 or even Web 1 comp that I can think of is PayPal and the PayPal button. PayPal creating a very simple button mechanism for online websites to onboard PayPal payments to their checkout flows was like a large part of their success in PayPal's adoption. And one of these major payment providers, like basically all the payment providers do that now, right? They just make it easy for you to add their payment flows to their checkouts. This is essentially that PayPal moment, or could be that PayPal moment, could be that PayPal moment for crypto payments. As far as like value accrual, you know, obviously it's good for Circle, being that they were the one showcased in the demo. And I think the biggest winner is actually the chain, because probably most activity in the long run on these chains is just like simple payments. If you look at what people do today, retail users, by far their most common financial transactions are simple payments. So if you're thinking about value accrual to an L1 token, or just getting that L1 token in the hands of more businesses and individuals, the introduction of crypto payments is that has the most impact there, I think.
I honestly thought this would have been with like Base. I'm a bit surprised that they onboarded. It was risky with Solana, to do a live demo with Solana. But Avalanche kind of surprised me. I honestly assumed that it would be Base, or it would have been Polygon, because I feel like they have that like BD, and that they would have been able to get in on this one. But
I mean, I guess Avalanche has done a great job recently also with their kind of BD department, and apparently have onboarded quite a lot of especially banks. So kind of makes sense for the like project to go there as well. But then what I'm thinking about is like, I wonder how it works on the back end, because I have no idea how this works. Because let's say Solana, for example, is extremely congested, and then you're trying to get your transactions through. Like, what happens if you try it 5 to 10 times and it still doesn't work, or there's some other problems there? Like, how would you solve for a situation like that? And that's why I'm also kind of surprised that they went with a public blockchain, because like, if you really wanted to do this and make it, I don't know, as functional or maybe as safe as possible, you would have just maybe created a private blockchain just for this stuff, and then like basically make sure that you have the capacity to meet the demand or whatever is happening in the market.
Yeah, it feels like this should have been an Avalanche subnet thing, because isn't this like the exact reason why they developed these things, is to make like easily deployable private blockchains, especially with Evergreen? But agreed, I would be so upset, like, if my transactions just weren't going through while I was trying to pay. And it's very important, like, because Stripe is set, it's for businesses to sell. And there's, like, those statistics that's, like, based on how little people have to click and how little time you give them to make a decision on shopping, the higher, like, your revenue goes. Because you basically want to limit the time that the shopper has to think about their purchase. I think it's like sub 15 seconds or something is ideal. But imagine like just trying to spam. Sometimes I'll be trying to buy something on Solana, and like the more you spam, the more you're like, ah, I just shouldn't be buying this one, I guess. This is not.
The interesting thing is it's actually milliseconds. Google has a study where every 15 milliseconds is incremental, like user disutility or something like that. It makes them that much less, or that's makes them that much more likely to churn on a website or in a payment flow. I think that like the important thing to remember here is like, who's the first customer of this service? Like, it's definitely not small businesses. It's definitely not enterprises. What it is like crypto native businesses and people who are going to use USDC for ideological reasons. So if you think about like, WIF raising money to put, you know, Dog with Hat on the Sphere, or like the Bonk store selling like Bonk branded coffee mugs, like that's the first place where you're going to see this process flow implemented. And like, if we like call to action, if we want to see crypto payments succeed, like whenever we can, we should make them. Right, because Stripe's going to see that, and they want to see that compounding adoption.
Yeah,
but so you're saying it's an opt-in thing, like not every kind of vendor who uses Stripe won't have this option for them immediately.
I would imagine it's an opt-in thing. I would imagine that there's a lot of flexibility there, but not an expert.
Okay, well then that kind of sucks then. Or I mean, it would make a lot of sense if it's just inbuilt from the beginning, because I'm not sure, but I'd say it's never a like bad option to have more, you know, payment options out there as long as your money isn't like taken away. So from a business perspective, it would be interesting to not just include him to everywhere, but maybe some businesses don't want that in the first place.
And I think it's like particularly cool, just normalizing crypto and in day-to-day life, but in particular, non-KYC, non-custodial wallets. And you really couldn't make a payment, like an online payment in Stripe, without a bank account. So I think that's a really cool step. And I mean, what are we doing if we're not connecting crypto things to the actual real world, right? So I think more integrations will also kickstart more positive cycles, like more clear use cases, more companies will want to build in crypto, more talent will come, more capital, and just build more useful applications. So I think it's a really cool step.
Yeah, it is a really awesome step. It's great to see. I do remember, however, it must have been April 21 when like PayPal and Visa like made big announcements that they were onboarding crypto payments, and I was like, this is the moment. And it wasn't, right? Like these things take like a long time to play out, is what we're realizing. And you know, I feel like every time I'm listening to an investor on a crypto pod that was around in like, I don't know, 2013 or 2016, like they've all said that, yeah, these things have taken longer to play out than we had previously thought. So I'm always tempering my expectations.
All right, moving on. There was kind of a clickbaity headline this week, but I think it still touches on something that's quite important in the markets. And that was that Brevan Howard has made a tiny investment in meme coins. Now, I don't know if they have. They may have. But I think this kind of speaks more to where we are right now, where we see these huge FDV, very low flow tokens launching basically every week. And I assume we're going to have a few more launching over the next few weeks. And it's kind of like people... I'd say like the retail participant has almost sort of given up on making an honest living trading cryptographic coins and more so have moved on to meme coins. And we've also seen like venture capital funds, like hedge funds, adopt meme coins as an investment, writing these blog posts, like multiple pages saying, oh, actually meme coins are like egalitarian and they could change everything. And on Twitter, you see this constantly where I feel like this is like both very fair, but also very obvious takes of like people saying, oh, meme coins are destroying the industry. Going back to kind of what Carolina said about like how we actually want to get like actual use cases around crypto. And then there's people saying, oh, actually like meme coins are the great equalizer and it's fantastic. I'm kind of in between. I like meme coins and... I think they're fine for the industry. I don't think they've been around. One thing I don't like is that I don't agree with the meme coin super cycle thesis. I think meme coins are just always meme coins and they've always done well. Like Doge has outperformed BTC over the last few cycles, so they've always done well. But I also don't think that they're like the worst thing to have ever happened. They're fine. But I think what's not fine is that there's a lot of people launching like 0.1 float tokens and then complaining about meme coins are ruining the industry. They're not. You are kind of not ruining the industry, but at least not doing good for it. What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes sense to kind of divide those two things, like low float tokens and then meme coins, and talk about them separately, because like, yeah, especially with meme tokens, if you take a position, you never really... or seldom can you have a real fundamental thesis on stuff. Like, yeah, you can look at how popular the meme is on social media and like where it will end up at some point. But still, to a certain extent, I'd say that's more like being in the casino and just trying to, you know, 10x your money, and you should be pretty, or have the expectation that you will lose everything. And that's why I think it's interesting that these like professional funds are apparently trying to take on more positions, because I can't imagine going to my LPs and being like, okay, guys, we're trying out this new strategy. I hope you don't mind it. It's going to be like, we pump 10% of the fund into meme coins. And then really the two outcomes there are either you're going to be the greatest, or you're going to be seen as the greatest trader ever, even though that's, I'd say, more luck-based, or then you're going to lose 10% of your fund. So I definitely want to see how like these fund managers go up to their, I don't know, like boards or then LPs, and trying to, you know, justify this decision and saying like, yeah, this is skill based. We know that this will like go up. Okay, maybe I'll continue on that note. Going back to the like low float stuff, that's where I feel like retail has become much more, you know, cognizant of what's going on. I think last cycle was more like, oh, this like kind of intrinsically valuable token that has governance rights is going up right now, which is great. And everybody or nobody really thought about like the underlying token structure. And for long, you've seen this opinion on the market, or like a lot of people are saying that, yeah, like FDV is a meme, it doesn't really matter. And then suddenly a lot of participants are like surprised that the token is down only when the float has gone from like 5% to 65% or whatever. So like that's just basic, you know, I don't know what to call it, basic mathematics maybe. But I guess we saw a similar phenomenon in the equity market as well, like a couple of decades ago maybe. And then the market just started realizing that, okay, like a low float thing just doesn't work in the long run, so we shouldn't even buy into these things. So on one hand, I also feel like this is something that the market naturally kind of figures out in the longer run. And then if you try to do this in the future, you're going to be called out, or your token won't do that well because everybody knows that, like, okay, we don't even want to touch this thing.
Yeah. People were saying that FTB doesn't matter, but I feel like above 70K BTC, everyone's like, oh, FTB doesn't matter. And now we're kind of realizing that FTB does matter. I kind of agree with you on the take that people will eventually realize that FTB does matter and like people will stop buying in. But I think like the best way to, I mean, it should just, it's just a natural equilibrium still though, because as a market, like if you're a smart retail or market participant, you're just farming these tokens and you're getting it like out at the highest FTB you can. And it, as a VC, your incentive is to launch at as high an FTB as possible anyway, so that you can exit as well. I think, why the face? Why not?
Because I feel that, yeah, maybe if you're like a short-term holder, or your like view is short-term, then that is valid to say that like the VC should kind of get as high of a starting FTB as possible. But if you're really a long-term holder and like aligned with the project, I feel like you don't want a situation where the token launches with a high FTV, or I don't know how to put it, with an intrinsically high FTV, because then that means that in the long run, like the market expectations are kind of skewed, and then everything starts going down at some point. And as a long-term holder, you're going to be damaged of that, or, you know, get damaged from that.
Yeah, it's a high FTV to begin on a project could actually destroy the project. Right, like we've all seen Silicon Valley, where the founder realizes that if he launched at a lower valuation, things would have been much easier, right? Like expectations would have been lower, he would still have his company. Like tokens go through that as well, and they risk alienating their communities if they start at that super high FTV and then proceed to dump. I think you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. I think some token structures, depending on what they're trying to accomplish, will necessarily have these low float dynamics, and then the team has to manage it appropriately. So one team that I think is doing a fantastic job with that is Hive Mapper. The way that the project works is that they give out honey tokens for people who map roads and contribute data to their systems so that they can sell to enterprises. They issue tokens based on an individual's contribution to that map, and very, very small amounts of tokens have hit the market over time. They had to manage those low flow dynamics, and they did so by completely cutting off any chatter about speculation in their Discords and their Telegrams. They made it very plainly obvious to the community that we're not about financial speculation or about building this map. If you want to contribute and get rewarded honey, do so, but we're not here to focus on token price. We're here to focus on building a global and usable map. I think they handle that really well in their comms, observing them from kind of day one. And other projects come to mind too, like WorldCoin, for example. Like, you will necessarily have low float there because you're onboarding people one by one and you get X amount of like WorldCoin tokens, right? Like, it's just a natural consequence of these systems, and they have to manage expectations of their user bases.
Yeah, but I mean, especially on the ladder part, I feel like it's a bit weird that the float is low, and then I get that you have to kind of manage the supply because you're going to be giving out tokens to your users. But at the same time, it's a bit of a weird dynamic where then some investors unlock 20% of the supply suddenly. You know what I mean? Like, those are a bit two separate things. And I, of course, understand that investors have to get out at some point as well, but it's just weird. Or it maybe makes weird incentives in that sense. I think what would be cool, maybe as a like a long-term structure, would be that everybody who's kind of contributing to the project, I don't know if investors could do this, but especially for the team, would be like, okay, you're going to get comped like this many tokens if we reach these KPIs, or if you're able to like grow the project in this way, as long as like the incentives or the incentive structure would be made in a, you know, good way, then I feel like it's easier for the market kind of to be on board with, okay, like everybody is still aligned with the project and not trying to, you know, just get out on the top or whatever.
Totally. Yeah. Like, the one thing that comes to mind when you say that is like valuation metrics provided by, you know, any kind of like trading software service, whether it be a CoinGecko or whatever. Like, there's no single agreed upon definition of circulating supply. So the information that participants have at their fingertips to make educated decisions is like, you have to put in a lot of effort. Like, I can very easily type in like AAPL and get all like standardized statistics on Apple's valuation across a number of different dimensions. I cannot do that in crypto. You know, if you're going to invest in these things professionally, you probably want to forecast out those unlocks and treat them like unlock tokens, right? You want to treat them as circulating supply, but we know that every project doesn't do that, right? They don't treat, a lot of projects don't treat investor unlocks as circulating supply until they exit those wallets, which, like, from first principles, I think is incorrect. So yeah, standardization, which, like, we're slowly getting there, but like we're nowhere close. Standardization will go a long way.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of people have now started to do N+1 for circulating supply, yep, as well, instead of what. But I agree with you. I mean, even if you try and find some of these unlock schedules, like now at least, I think a good example, and we'll talk more about these guys in a bit, but I think a good example of this was Renzo and their pie chart. Like, there's just these teams that kind of obfuscate how tokenomics look. And the worst is when they just release their like supply schedule, but it's just the chart and there's no dates. There's no, it's just a percent, and you can't, like, you have to like do it with your mouse pointer. You reach out to the team and they don't respond in time. So it's definitely a minefield. And the reason that I decided to combine the low FTV and the meme coin talk was because I think, and I think a lot of other people think this as well, is that because it's been such a minefield, there's this. I'm not a big fan of the like pessimism, but I think a lot of people assume that retail has just shifted towards meme coins, where they have the same equal chance as VCs. But I don't even think that's true anymore, because now we're seeing more and more KOL rounds and like raises for meme coins. And I feel like they do this every time. Like the initial run up with Pepe, towards the end of it, you started seeing like VC, not VC obviously, but like fundraised memes. And now we're seeing more and more of it again. So it's going to be interesting to see how much like juice is left in the tank for the meme thing.
I have thoughts on KOL rounds. I think at times they seem maybe unfair, and they're often viewed with skepticism. I guess it's more of a question: how much different is that from like marketing in traditional markets, right? Where you're outright paying someone to speak about your product that they now have a financial interest in. Like we all watch commercials where celebrities are literally shilling products to people, saying that it's better than the next thing when they probably don't use it themselves. And they're just getting, they're just getting a check cut to them, right? Like it's not that different. I understand that like token dynamics may muddy may cause it to seem more illegitimate than otherwise, but I don't see a way around it, I think, is what I'm trying to say. I don't see a way around paying people to influence public perception on public crypto projects.
I think it's just a bit demoralizing for the general population, because you see these guys get these rounds and they're getting them at a discount, sometimes to like Series B, like whatever number they've raised, like they're getting it a discount at that. And then they get different terms as well. So they'll get like, this is probably an exaggerated example, but they'll get 60% unlock at TGE. And then you're like, okay, well, I think it's more like, I understand what you mean. And another difference is that like in this scenario, you could be losing thousands of dollars versus like, obviously you can lose a lot of money if you buy something that a celebrity is talking about as well, but it's, I would say like lesser. It's like 40, 50 bucks. Maybe you buy a product that some celebrity has shilled versus like if you buy a token that your favorite influencer shilled and they dump it on your head despite clicking that button that said, I promise to sell carefully, then you're hurt, you're demoralized, you're very upset. And then you say, how can I make it all back? And that's the meme coin thing.
Yeah, I guess the pushback is that I think it's the user base or like the group of people that you're selling to empirically really value openness and transparency, and KOLs are really the antithesis of that. I think that's a good way to frame it.
But like, I guess the market doesn't like these KOL rounds that much either, because if you look at recent performance of almost whatever KOL project, it's down only. So maybe not the best structure to get your token to perform well out of the gate. Not financial advice, by the way.
Yeah, I don't know a lot about KOL rounds. Like, it can't be a large portion of the allocation, right? Like, do you think the sell pressure for those projects is attributable to those key opinion leaders?
Well, I guess it kind of depends on the structure case by case, but as Boko said, like a lot of the times they get preferable terms compared to other entities. So then it becomes maybe a combination of low float and large KOL unlock relative to others, which might or might not lead to like sell pressure. I'm just speculating here.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that is supposed to be fixing this, or I guess is like a product that is going to try and fix this, is Kobe's Echo. I wonder if you guys have any takes on this. I completed the KYC thing. It was quite intense, but it makes sense. He wants to make sure that nothing can be go wrong, and I respect that. I feel like I saw another product that was similar to this as well. It's called like Bidness Club or Bidding Club. I'm not sure if you guys saw that. But I fundamentally like that idea of creating groups to share allocation. I think it makes sense. I'm not sure if it'll be like the great equalizer, but I think it's like a very valid effort. But I don't know if you guys have any more like interesting takes.
Yeah, I agree that it's a really valid effort. There is the question that you still have to kind of apply to be in a group, right? So the group leaders are the ones that choose the project that they want to fund, and then you kind of have to participate with them in a round. So it's not like it's going to be super 100% open to everyone. But I think it's a great step in the right direction. And yeah, it's a bit long, the whole process. And I think it also makes it a bit more serious. And it is like you are giving away all your protections or everything from, like, in my case, the European Union. And you're saying, I am not certified, but professional investor, and so I'm aware that I will lose all my money, and I'm happy to invest in this. So I think regulation-wise, they took a lot of care to build a really good product that you can trust. I think Kobe has also been like very positive in this space since forever. I don't know how many deals were already closed. I don't know if it's like public knowledge. But I think it's a great product. I'm really happy to see it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a fair question to ask, like, should retail investors even be able to access these deals in the first place? Because they are quite risky, and then you can make the argument like, not everybody knows what, like, they should do maybe with their capital. But at the same time, like, I feel that At a certain point, after like an investor, whoever it is, after they've given enough information and like the rules have been clearly laid out that, okay, like you are taking on a lot of risk. There is a large chance that you won't get any of your money back. Like if they've got this information and still want to invest, I don't see why it should be regulated. Like, even if you want to make it super bare bone or a super bare bone comparison, I would say you could say that it's just similar to gambling or whatever. And even that's kind of legal in most places, at least outside of the US and some places in Asia. But I think it's fair to let everybody get the same chances at least.
Yeah, I think the closest competitor to this in crypto, like in terms of giving access to early stage deals used to be Fjord, like liquidity bootstrapping. Because I think originally that was designed to be something that was similar to this for people to raise, not from VCs, but from the general market. But it's become like not that anymore. I mean, they do two rounds before, they have a KOL round, and then they do a liquidity bootstrapping thing as well. I mean, if that's the best other competitor, like this is, I obviously like VC investments are really risky, longer term, you might never get the exit. It's very liquid, but it's definitely like, I think it's depending on the project, I think it's a fairer shot than what like Fjord has been recently. I don't know if you guys have looked into any Fjord tokens or if any of our listeners have, but I mean, those have just been horrific, horrific PA. Comparable to like just the entire, they're having their own bear market now. Yeah, let's move on to, I'd say, like the biggest drama over the last few days, IONET. Ryan, I called on you last time to give an IONET briefing. I'm calling on you again. Do you have any takes?
Yeah, so I guess just a little background first for those who haven't followed. Over the weekend, Martin Shkreli, otherwise known as Pharma Bro, hurled accusations at the IONET team. Two broad accusations. One, that the one less consequential one, one more consequential. The less consequential is that the project is flooded with bots, being promoted by bots, and full of bots. The other is that the GPU count on their Explorer and the GPUs that they have available is incorrect, or is misleading. So like just first, like why this matters, I think. I personally believe that this space, kind of like decentralized compute deep in space, is one of the best shots on goal that we have in crypto to convincing a lot of people in Web2 that like token incentives and crypto rails do solve a problem that a lot of people today have, which is access to compute resources. And it would be a shame if, you know, that were to be taken off the rails by like a scam project. So super interested in what's going on here. I think it's important to take a close look at what Martin is saying and talk about where he's right and where he's wrong. First about like where he's right. Undoubtedly, the IONET project, either by fault of their own or consequences of just the general market and having a TGE coming up, was inundated with bots. I believe that they hit the max people in a Telegram group within the month. And if you participate in Telegram or Discord, you know that a lot of the content is bot-generated content. If you have followed the project, you know it's just been like a constant. It's been a constant problem, and it's a really hyped project. So, like, understandably, that's going to happen. I don't envy their position having to deal with that problem. The other part where Martin is right is in the GPU count. Like, undoubtedly, it was wrong. And if you participated in the project over the last month or two, you've seen that GPU number go parabolic. And undoubtedly, if you're familiar with crypto, you were like, Sybil attack. Now, where Martin was wrong, in all fairness to the IONET team, they came out probably 3 days before saying that they were Sybil attacked and our GPU counts are wrong. They came out plainly and stated that. The numbers, the metadata on their website was corrupt. The amount of available GPUs was misleading. Could they have done more? Like, sure. Like, should there have been a banner on the website saying, like, please don't trust these numbers today, we're working on it? Like, sure. Like, sometimes a Twitter post isn't enough. I think that, like, look, the IONET project, it is a very ambitious project. They're trying to do things that are technically very challenging. I think in all fairness, in the spirit of moving fast and breaking things, to point out that a tech project is not working as described, might not be best for that project and might be a little bit unfair. And I think like as like a more of a meta comment, comms, like we said earlier, like the you have a lot of stakeholders as a Web3 company because of the token. Just by definition, you have more stakeholders than a Web2 company. And those stakeholders are very sensitive they value very highly openness and transparency. And because of that, comms are extraordinarily important. Bot activity is off-putting. Incorrect numbers on the Explorer are off-putting. And if you don't handle those things in the right way, like, you could lose your project, right? Like, it might not work out for you. So I think the meta lesson here is just that, like, comms are extraordinarily important. You have to be on top of your data. You have to fight bot activity. And again, it's not a position I am envious in. I'm sure it's like super hard to fight away the bots in this environment.
Yeah, and I'm sure that given how ambitious the project is, they have a lot of stuff to do in addition to comms and like watching for Sybil attacks and all of that stuff. So it must be super hard to like trying to control everything that's going around. And then it's also sometimes like hard to tell whether, for example, crypto Twitter is just being trying to be like, you know, I don't know, haters, if you want to put it in Zoomer speak, but like you don't always know if the criticism is warranted or not. And then I feel that sometimes the best thing to do is just wait for a while and see how the situation develops.
Yeah, totally. I mean, just poking around today, you know, last night, Skrelly was convinced that they had no GPUs. IONET showed him like how to actually get the right metadata to see the actual cluster. He said, thank you, like my bad. And now he's claiming that they don't have the GPUs again. Right. So like, it's a very fluid situation. Accusations are being hurled. Best bet is like you step back, you like let the dust settle and then assess. Like, it's really hard to know what's going on right now.
Yeah, and I guess Krelly is also trying to launch something within the space. So maybe he's trying to advertise something. Like, it's always good to remember that everybody usually has some incentive to do something.
Yeah, I do wonder, to our listeners, we talked about this morning as well. And one of the things that we kind of agreed on was that everybody slightly knew that those numbers were overinflated. One thing that I didn't know was that Shkreli was launching his own decentralized AI thing. And like Brick said, I feel like that's kind of... he was also talking about Tao a few weeks back, and he was making the same claims that I think everybody makes about Tao as well. So it's like these very like obvious deficiencies in these projects, such as like Tao, I don't know if it's gameable. And with IONET, I don't know if like it's fake. These like, as price goes down, people really like bringing up a lot of these issues that I feel like a lot of people are already aware of. All right, this is a good place to move on to our next segment. But before that, a quick word from Clusters, thanks to our sponsor, Layer Zero.
All right, guys, for this week's Layer Zero segment, we have ZeroX Fubar, founder of Clusters, a universal cross-chain name service. Thank you so much for coming on, Fubar.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So just to kick us off, what was the problem that sparked the idea for Clusters?
The main problem is that I got too many wallets on too many chains and lost track of all of them. I think this is a very common crypto power user problem. I came into crypto with one MetaMask hot wallet, one ETH, and a dream one day. And I left back a year later and I had 17 different wallets across 7 different chains and NFTs I must have bought while drunk. So Clusters aim to fix this. I think we live in a world of burgeoning complexity. There's a new chain that launches every single week, it seems. There's a new wallet that comes out. And even within that, the apps, the DEX you use on Blast might be different than the DEX you use on Ethereum. So Clusters kind of aims to bring this all back together. There's a famous quote, there are only two business models in the world, bundling and unbundling. And crypto is definitely in its unbundling or modularity phase, but Clusters aims to, I think, build the first universal app that no matter what chain you're on, it's a seamless experience that brings all your assets and familiar flows together.
Yeah, that's a very relatable problem. So I'm pretty excited about what you're building over at Clusters, but how does Layer Zero fit into the protocol's design and how difficult are different integrations to spin up? Like, is that something that's on your guys' team on your end, or is it more the people looking to integrate? Like, is that on their end?
Yeah. The fundamental problem with universal apps, with cross-chain apps, is that the bridges are less reliable than Baltimore. You've got, it seems like a new bridge collapses every single month. What was it? Even canonical semi-enshrined ones. Look at Phantom adopted multi-chain as their pseudo-canonical bridge. And then multi-chain devs have not been heard of since the recent Chinese government raid and all their assets were stolen and dumped. You've had similar hack issues on a wide number of bridges. So it's very, very hard to take on the risk, the additional marginal risk of bridge trust assumptions generally. And so I think that the bridge space has not been mature enough to build reliable cross-chain apps for quite some time. The why now is that for the first time, I think Layer 0 V2 is both immutable enough but composable enough with the highest security bounty in the world to that we can really rely on it and build hyperstructures on top. So yeah, there's kind of the meme was that everybody's building infrastructure and nobody's building apps. But it's not really true. The infrastructure is so quite brittle. So with respect to what that means for us, it lets, I mean, being able to rely on kind of tested security structures from layer zero lets us be more aggressive and fast moving in terms of expansion while still focusing on as decentralized protocols as possible.
Nice. That's great to hear why you guys chose layer zero as a solution and how V2 really enabled Custer as an idea to be built. One last question I wanted to ask is, how has adoption been? And has there been anything that has sort of like pleasantly surprised you in how people are using clusters?
Mm-hmm. Adoption has been off the charts. We launched 2 months ago. We've seen over 80,000 unique names registered already, surpassing even ENS's steady state. So the biggest excitement has been how many people truly are using clusters for its purpose. You scroll through the feed and people are configuring, people have their wallets from what seems like 12 different chains all in one cluster. Solana, Bitcoin, Ethereum, the L2s, other EVML1s. And so that's really fun to see.
Awesome. Well, that is unfortunately all the time we have left for today, but we will be sure to link to Cluster's social account in the show notes. But thanks so much for coming on, Fubar.
Perfect. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. We're back. One other piece of big news last week was the Easy ETH DPEG. I think, and this might be kind of a dumb take, that this was due to people being upset about the airdrop, as well as the pie chart tweet. I saw some numbers that made it seem like it DPEX 70%, like one easy ETH was worth 0.3 ETH. I'm not sure if that, how sustained that was. But I think it like kind of brings it back to this very obvious issue that LRTs have, and it's just duration. You don't know when you're going to be able to exit. And a lot of them, I think EtherFi is the only one that has withdrawals. I don't think any of the other ones have withdrawals. But I'm not sure if you guys have any other thoughts on this one. This was just like, I feel like it just happened for a day and then it caused like liquidation and like Morpho and Gearbox. And then the day after they were like, oh, we're going to increase the airdrop allocation, which shows that bullying teams works. It improves tokenomics drastically.
Yeah, I mean, maybe worth going over the mechanisms a bit first. Like, my understanding here is that basically people got mad about the airdrop structure, which then made a lot of people dump the token. And because you couldn't withdraw it, or you could, maybe. But anyway, people, I guess, market sold, which then, of course, causes the peg to go down. And then that probably gets even worse when people start getting liquidated on these like looped strategies, and that probably caused that. But I don't know how to like react to this news really, because this just shows that, as you said, if you bully a team, then they'll change the structure. So that kind of makes an incentive where maybe if the team, I'm not saying this team isn't like super honest, but maybe a team that isn't that honest knows that, okay, we can try this like shady structure at first, and then if the market pushes back, we just like change the structure to something more sensible. So some teams will always know that, okay, we can like try and like get this through, and if it doesn't work, then we'll just revert back to something sensible.
But I think it will, like, I don't think it has ever fully, well, it kind of recovered, but at least it was trading at always a bit like 1.something ETH, and now it's always like 0.98 or 99. So I don't think it would be a good strategy in the sense that I think it will be kind of, at least for the next few months, tainted with this image. And I think it could also tell us a bit about like, these projects are all a bit half-baked in the sense that you can deposit, but you can't withdraw. Probably if withdrawals were enabled, then this would have been much, much smoother. And maybe it's a good take to like remind projects that they should kind of, you know, just launch the full project before having like so much money inside them.
I think the big takeaway for me is that this is just like a glimpse of what you will see in a world of restaking and rehypothecation. Like, this was very benign, right? Like, it was a funny pie chart, and it caused like 20 million in liquidations and a smaller amount in bad debts throughout DeFi. And like, the thing about rehypothecation is that it like necessarily adds fragility and systemic risk to a system. That's fine. We all know that. But when you couple that with crypto's appetite for loop strategies that contain leverage and auto liquidations when they unwind, things can, and smart contract risk, things can get very dicey. I don't spend enough time in like the ETH ecosystem to know how seriously the potential impacts of rehypothecation are taken by like core teams and EF people. But I do see the TVL numbers for Eigenlayer, and there's clearly, and the surrounding protocols, and there's clearly an appetite for rehypothecation to get like incremental additional yield. And it doesn't appear to be a lot, which is worrisome. If things go like, cycle's not over, right? Like, things can get way more out of hand if people don't manage their positions well.
Yeah, but maybe worth noting that this problem is probably made worse right now by the fact that you can loop your points as well. So I feel that that's kind of exacerbated the risk right now. But there will, of course, be a risk, as you like mentioned.
One thing I find kind of funny is that if you talk to anybody about like, oh, like, what do you think are like the risks of Eigenlayer restaking? They'll bring it up. They'll say like, oh, there's like obvious risk with like these liquid restaking tokens. But like Ryan said, I feel like not everybody's kind of digesting that. The fact that they're looping everything, which is fine because you want to earn extra points, obviously. Like, you want to farm the protocol. You want to do your... like loop your YT points as well. But it just like, I don't want to be a doomer, but I feel like eventually it might not end particularly well. And imagine being the guy that got liquidated on like Easy ETH last week. I would be so upset. I would be like devastated. I think that's one thing people don't think about. They're like, oh, it's Eigenlayer. Like, the risk there is risk, but it's not like risky. And then boom, it's like drop 70% and you're just staring at your wallet. Single tier shedding.
Yeah, all leverage strategies end poorly. Like in every single market in the history of financial markets, if I think about these systems, I think a lot about traditional financial markets, and I can't help but see like the guardrails around rehypothecation are the reasons why the unwinds in TradFi are so less disastrous than here. Like, we have the FDIC. The FDIC has an emergency fund. Like, we have the Fed. Even the Treasury stepped in March of 2023 to help. There are caps on the amount of lending that a bank can do, and reserve requirements. And there are withdrawal limits on individual accounts. Like, the whole system has had like 200 years of like figuring out how to handle like rehypothecation risk. And it feels like we're just letting it rip. Like, I understand there's like committees that are thinking about this, and like the Eigenlayer team is talking about guardrails. It is the guardrails in crypto and risk management practices around rehypothecation strategies are orders of magnitude off from what is in TradFi. And that's systemic risk.
Yeah. I mean, you're also allowing potentially the people who have the highest risk appetite in the world, who like put 100x longs on random meme coins.
Totally. There's no reason why I can't rehypothecate my whiff, and someone will build that and I'll have the ability to do that. And like, what are the implications there? Like, I don't know. It's there's a lot of asymmetry. Let's put it that way.
I give that 3 months before somebody starts rehypothecating meme coins because they've already started doing points and stuff now. But we'll see.
But yeah, I guess it's just a sign of maybe developing market because, yeah, as you said, even TradFi markets had problems with this stuff historically. And then when something like Terrible happens, or that's usually, I guess, what's needed. Like at first, everyone says that, okay, this is fine. Like Terra Luna stuff, yeah, this is fine. We have a great backup fund if anything happens. Okay, that didn't go that well. So now I guess we already have some regulation around, like, especially stable coins. So yeah, if anything happens, I feel that at least after a catastrophic thing, usually the market gets better then. So if nothing else positive to take away there is that, like, yeah, if something was to happen, the market will probably be safer afterwards.
Yeah. We just need to develop our lore a bit more, is your take. We need to go through a little bit more struggle.
Hey, I'm not saying that. You said that.
Okay. Talking about points farming, I don't know how good of a segue this is going to be, but another points program that is supposed to end this week or next week is Hyperliquid. Our very own Carolina has done a potentially the best, like the longest and the most comprehensive deep dive on Hyperliquid very recently, exclusively for our subscribers. Carolina, do you want to kind of give your thoughts on that a little bit?
Yeah. So the Hyperliquid points program is finishing very soon. It should end in about 1 or 2 weeks. And I think it's an exciting time for the project. It has been consistently for about 3 months now, ranking in the top three DEXs, perp DEXs in terms of daily volume. And now it's sort of a moment of truth where we find out just how much volume and all the other impressive metrics have been inflated by the points program. There's no question that users have been farming the airdrop. It's more of a question of how much and how many will stay. And I may be an optimist, but I do think that even people who deposited in the platform just to get some points probably enjoyed the trading experience and might actually make Hyperliquid their go-to perp DEX. It is pretty smooth and fast. There are today 130 assets listed, pre-launch token markets, vaults for copy trading and market making strategies. Trading is gasless and you can deposit USDC from Arbitrum very easily. It has generated $140 billion in volume and attracted 110K new users since the beginning of this year. And daily volume has been consistently exceeding $1 billion. And I think the deposit UI flow is so seamless that most people don't really realize it's actually a bridge, which is a great thing because they managed to build their own L1 and optimize it for high performance, low latency while keeping the UX abstracted to this fact. So I think this is the only way we can start actually bridging the gap between prep DEXs and centralized exchanges by focusing on UX and performance. And to give some more details, Hyperliquid right now is not only a prep DEX anymore. Very recently, the team has unveiled native spot trading. And it had been in the works for a while in the testnet. And around 2 weeks ago, there was an airdrop of PER tokens to points holders. And that was the first token launched on the Hyperliquid L1. So the launch of this native spot trading came with two new native token standards, the HIP-1 and HIP-2. And the first is a fungible token standard that incorporates on-chain spot order books between pairs of tokens. And the second one is designed for bootstrapping liquidity via an on-chain market making strategy. And it is integrated directly into the block transition logic of the chain itself. And the vision here is for the spot and the perp DEXs to be kind of the primary source of liquidity upon which all the other apps that eventually are added to the L1 then can thrive. So basically, instead of building a chain and incentivizing teams to build on it, and just incentivize users to bridge to it, they did it the other way around, focusing on making the chain very performant and a challenging product, just building a very performant, challenging product and the user base to later on add other apps to it. So we'll have to wait and see to see if actually projects will come and build on this new L1 and how easy it will be to introduce new tokens and to bridge new assets. but it seems like a more long-term plan now in any case. It is, however, I think relevant to know this when trying to make sense of the value of the native token that will launch now very soon, probably. The tokenomics haven't come out yet, but we know the token will have a role in securing the network, which is proof of stake. So the documentation mentions that staking and slashing will be similar to Cosmos chains. The token's influence may also extend to the asset listing process, and it will definitely be used to pay for gas in the future on the L1. So it's interesting that although the project is very known for the perp DEX, the token can actually have very clear utility at the infrastructure level. And I will stop here.
I was just going to say that, you know how you were like, oh, the bridging is very seamless? It is very seamless because I didn't even know it was an L1 when I first bridged. I was like, I just thought I deposited it to a vault, but apparently I bridged over, which is kind of insane. I'm kind of excited to see if people are going to stay on after the points program. I know a lot of people are saying Hyperliquid's a great perp DEX. I'm sure it is. I don't really trade that much on perps. I feel like I'd get liquidated immediately. But a lot of people are saying it's very, very good. I feel like a lot of people said that about Vertex as well. And they also said that about like a million other tokens. I'm sure this one could be very, very good. I'm excited to see because they do have really good. Avo and Hyperliquid have done very, very good job doing pre-launch tokens. And I think that was a really good way to capture the meta, especially since we had a lot of these points programs and then like teased airdrops for months and months. So they did well there. And I know their product is, people are happy with it. So I'm excited to see how it's all going to turn out.
Is there any public information on the like trade latency numbers for something like a Hyperliquid or an Avo versus centralized exchange?
I only know that they are capable of managing 20K orders per second. And compared to Binance, that's like very little, but it's a lot compared to like Solana.
Yeah. It seems to be that is the hurdle, right? And why you see these perp DEXs kind of moving to constructing their own chains is just to optimize the hell out of it to get them at parity with those centralized exchanges. I think they'll be able to do it, but it seems like it's a long road there. It's a long road ahead.
Yeah, what I'm most interested in seeing is it feels that a lot of perp DEXs, like the quality is getting better and better, and then the like kind of competitive advantages on the UX side are getting smaller and smaller. So yeah, as Bocco said, like I feel Avo and then Hyperliquid have probably done pretty well also, like in addition to them running the incentive programs, is them having the pre-launch markets, which then gets kind of customers into the door and maybe integrated to the community, and then they like continue trading over there. Meanwhile, a lot of other perp DEXs are just running like points programs or some other type of incentive programs. So I don't know, it will be interesting to see like where kind of a market equilibrium lies, where suddenly you don't need to incentivize usage anymore in a similar way, but I guess more like your market share kind of stabilizes, which I feel that, for example, the lending market is kind of, or has historically kind of went in that direction maybe until Spark launched. But, you know, now it seems that it's super volatile. Like suddenly a new perp DEX can come out and suddenly take up like 15 or 20% of the market, which is kind of an interesting phenomenon.
Yeah, I feel like they're always trying something new with perp DEXs as well. I don't think they've iterated that much on lending and borrowing markets. I'm sure there's some stuff out there that's like novel, but I feel like you don't want that much novelty in your lending and borrowing. You want like your assets to be as safe as possible, versus with perps, you might take a few risks. I actually, with Hyperliquid, one, Ryan, this goes back to like what you said about the latency. I know this isn't what you meant when you were comparing it to the sexes, but I feel like Hyperliquid's main competition isn't a sex. It's DYDX or whatever the most popular one is now besides for Hyperliquid. Like the established player is the competition and not like market share wise or whatever, but I feel like that's the same. The user who's on DYDX, that's who they want to attract, because funds can't trade on I mean, they can trade on DYDX, I guess, to an extent, maybe the larger assets, but they can't really trade on Hyperliquid at all. There's just no, they take up like 30% of the OI, you know?
Yeah, I'm thinking about two things. So what you said now at the end, like professional traders, it's really difficult. Although I have talked to some people that were either building like vaults on top of Hyperliquid or professional traders that were actually like running some market making strategies. And what they said is that the APIs and the SDKs are really, really easy to integrate with. And I feel like that's something that doesn't really, that we don't really know like as an end user, but it's cool to know because it makes like everything much more seamless to integrate. It just makes more apps reliant on Hyperliquid. So that could be a cool thing for them. And regarding DYDX, I think that's why also Hyperliquid is kind of leaning into this kind of attention focus. They're always listing the newest assets and with the pre-launch tokens. And they also have those vaults. I'm not sure if DYDX has something similar, but they basically have copy trading vaults or market making strategy vaults. So you can just see the performance and put your money there and kind of not do anything while it's trading for you. And all of those little things, I think, make the UX maybe a bit more interesting or exciting at least.
Yeah, I feel like the vaults are a great marketing tool. I see the vaults more than anything else on Twitter. It's just people are like, oh, look, X lost 30% on their vault this week. Haha. And then it's just like, you're always reminded of Hyperliquid.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be interesting because I just feel like there's really no large-scale passive strategies you can deploy that's going to make money for you like consistently, kind of in perpetuity. Or I'm just being reminded of AVO's like OG options vaults, which kind of performed in a quite stable way for a while, but then suddenly when the market like turns against you, your performance drops by like, let's say 7%. Putting you like equal or close to 0% if you started from, let's say, the beginning of the year. So that's just, I guess, a tough problem to solve. And I don't know if that's going to be, you know, possible to solve, because at least until now, like if we don't count for maybe the Medallion fund, which is like a TradFi fund that's doing pretty well, like everything else is either moving with the market or kind of worse than a passive strategy is moving in the market.
Yeah, the vault strategy is just like vaults. The Hyperliquid vaults are interesting though, because you basically get to put your money where your mouth is. Like if you're talking constantly on Twitter and saying, oh, I'm one of the best like traders, and then you can just launch a Hyperliquid vault, capture whatever fee they take. I think it's 10%. And then you can just let people invest in you. But that ribbon is like, it was the ribbon vaults. They just, I don't even think they were doing like negative 7%. I think they were losing money overall. And then they were advertising that this strategy has like a 47% return. And then the historical APY was like minus 28% or something like that. So the vault is, it's trying to sell vaults to a niche ecosystem of like people who overtrade and actively trade all the time for passive strategies. I feel like it's always a difficult way to market yourself.
No, but I mean, maybe I express myself badly there, but of course it depends on like from where you start looking at the performance of the vault. But especially for ribbon vaults, just because I don't want to dunk on them, or I want to make clear that like the performance was pretty stable and like positive, but then you'd have this like short 2-week periods where suddenly the market turns against you. So like if you traded through these vaults, you just had to be careful, or you still had to know what you was doing, you know. Okay, I'm not gonna invest in this week because like I think the performance or the market structure is such that the performance this week will be bad. I'm just saying that it's hard to create a passive strategy that's really like outperforms constantly, maybe.
Michael Saylor has a really good take on this. Have you heard him? His passive strategy on outperforming consistently. This is not financial advice, but I would recommend. The one chair strategy is a fantastic one, apparently, allegedly, NFA. Feels like, unless we have any other takes on guaranteed passive income strategies, we can end it off over there. Thank you all very much for listening. Thank you, Ryan, Carolina, and Brick for joining. Have a nice day.
Thanks for having us.